Welcome to Novelist Spotlight. This is Mike Consul, your host. In addition to being the host of this podcast and interviewing novelists, I am a novelist myself. I have three published novels. My latest is titled Lolita Firestone, a supernatural novel, and it is set in Sedona, Arizona and Cairo, Egypt. My previous novel is titled Family Recipes, a novel about Italian culture, Catholic guilt, and the culinary crime of the century. And my first novel is named Hardwood, a novel about college basketball and other games young men play. And that story deals with issues ranging from depression and racism to sex, religion, and university politics. All three novels are listed in the episode notes. I hope you will buy them, I hope you will read them, and I hope you will thoroughly enjoy them. Now, on with our program.
In the spotlight is Cornell University Professor of Literature, Robert Morgan, who will discuss the life, times, and writing of the historic novelist Thomas Wolfe, and in fact, has a good deal in common with the author. Thomas Wolfe hails from Asheville, North Carolina, a place I've been to several times, beautiful Asheville, North Carolina, up in the mountains. And Robert Morgan hails from Henderson County, just south of Asheville. They have the same birthday, interestingly enough. It's October 3rd. Both are Tar Heels, having graduated from UNC Chapel Hill. UNC as in University of North Carolina, for those of you maybe listening from some far-flung places. And each lived most of their adult lives in the northern recesses of the United States. Robert Morgan is at Cornell University. As I said earlier, he came to Cornell as a visiting lecturer in 1971 for 1 year and has been there ever since. This is no surprise to me. I grew up in upstate New York. I've been to Ithaca many times. What a beautiful town that is. Cayuga Lake sitting right in the middle of it. Cornell's beautiful campus there in Cornell. Robert Morgan lives in a Greek Revival farmhouse just outside of Ithaca. And of course, Robert is here to illuminate on the life and literary career of the great American novelist Thomas Wolfe, who was born in Asheville, North Carolina. As I said, that was the year 1900. He died in Baltimore, Maryland in 1938, living only 37 years. But that was enough time to make him, for him to make an indelible literary impression. Now, Robert Morgan himself is an American poet, short story writer, novelist, and a writer of nonfiction books as well. 15 books of poetry, 9 volumes of fiction, 3 nonfiction books. I call that prolific. Robert Morgan, welcome to the program.
Oh, it's very good to be here.
I really appreciate you taking the time. One of the great American novelists, Thomas Wolfe, has influenced a lot of people. So let me start there. How has your own fiction writing and perhaps your poetry been influenced by the writing of Thomas Wolfe?
Well, the two important ways. One, I discovered him when I was about 14 or 15. And since he came from Asheville, about 40 miles away, he gave me the idea that somebody from the mountains of North Carolina might just become a writer and even a very successful writer. So he inspired me to think about becoming a writer. I just loved Lycomer d'Angel, was intoxicated by that wonderful poetic prose. But the second and perhaps the more important way he influenced me was after I came to Cornell in the early 1980s, I read his novella, The Web of Earth, which is entirely a monologue spoken by a woman based on his mother, telling him about Asheville and all the gossip and things of the town. I was beginning to write fiction. I wanted to write a novel. And it was like a eureka moment. I said, I can let the character tell her own story. And that was really the beginning of my writing of longer fiction after years of concentrating on poetry. I realized that if you get the voice, once you hear the voice, you let your character tell her story. And it became exciting to do that. I could hardly wait up to get up in the morning to let her continue her story. So that began with my novella, The Mountains Won't Remember Us, and that led to a novel called The Hinterlands, and then Gap Creek, my most popular novel.
Now, one of them was a bestseller. Was that the bestseller right there?
It was. It became a New York Times bestseller in 2000.
Now, tell me about poetry, because first and foremost, it sounds like you're a poet. You've written more poetry than anything else. Maybe you see yourself just as much as a novelist as a poet, but before Thomas Wolfe wrote that landmark novel and kind of broke some ice for you, you were writing poetry. What is the attraction to poetry? Is it the economy? Is it the, well, I'll leave it at that. What really drew you to poetry?
So much, it's hard to describe it. The sound, the lyricism, the images, the metaphoric energy of poetry.
Now you say images. So you are a visual writer. And what I mean by that, or reader. So what I mean by that is not necessarily that you are writing things that are highly visual, but you, when you're reading poetry, or probably fiction as well, or writing your own, you're seeing the imagery in some regard.
The imagery is very important, particularly metaphoric imagery, where you see one thing in terms of another. I think that's kind of the basis of poetic energy. I became less of an imagistic poet as I developed got more interested in the sound of it, and even more important, in the voice of it, the voice, the
Distinguish those. So
movement.
there's the sound and then there's the voice. So suss that out for us. What's the distinction between the two?
Well, you could have a poem. All poems have a sound, of course, but not all poems have a recognizable voice of the speaker, the character telling the poem, in a sense. Sometimes the dramatic monologue, we call it. But every poem is a voice, in a sense. And as I developed as a poet, after I came to Cornell, I got much more interested in the sound of the voice telling the poem. And of course, using other senses than just visual sound, but also smell is a very important sense in writing. It has an immediacy in a sense that no other sense does. If you can get, the reader to smell what's going on, you're a long way into the experience and communicating the experience.
Well, isn't that what they teach us about writing? And you probably teach your students is that you want to engage all of the senses. And it's very easy just to tell a story. I shouldn't say very easy, but somebody could get into the storytelling mode and not necessarily think in terms of, am I creating a sensory experience for the reader? Has there been audio? Has it been auditory? Has it been tactile? Has it been olfactory? Am I using the word right? It's olfactory is a sense of smell, correct?
Right.
There you go. So, and that's got to be a fairly, well, actually, in some ways, it can be simple, like bacon and coffee. People can immediately relate to that, but that's almost grabbing at the lowest hanging fruit possible. Talk to us about what people don't get about poetry. There's a lot of writers out there. I count myself among them who doesn't really get poetry in terms of it's never really drawn me in. What might I not be getting, or what do a lot of people not get about poetry, do you think?
Well, the first thing is the sound, the way the words sound. We live in a visual age. We spend our lives looking at computer screens, phone screens, at pages, but poetry is from an oral tradition. And it's the sound of language and that voice, even the storyteller's voice, that is so important. So when you teach these days, you have to encourage the students to listen to what they write and to read aloud what they're writing. And they find that very hard because they've never listened so closely to language. In fact, if you teach metrics, let's say blank verse, they have a lot of trouble hearing that da-da, da-da, da-da. They've never thought of language in that way. They've never attended to it. So it's a major step if you get students to listen to words. And modern poetry, contemporary poetry, doesn't pay much attention to the sound the way poetry used to. So when I'm teaching, I first try to get the students to listen to a poem, and I have them read them aloud in class, a poem by Shakespeare or Frost or Walt Whitman, just to savor the sound of it. And they love that. Usually, when you get them to hearing, what blank verse actually is, and the way in which metrics are in contrast with the cadence of words. As in music, we have the beat, but we also have the phrasing of the music. And that's a real breakthrough for some students to listen to poetry in that way.
Who influenced you poetically? Was there a particular poet or two or three that really fired your interest in it or helped you develop the skill?
Well, I always loved poetry from the time I was a kid. We had to memorize Edgar Allan Poe in class and recite The Raven or To Helen or Annabel Lee. But a kind of breakthrough moment for me was when I was, I guess, about 15. My sister had gone off to college. When she came back, she brought her anthology of American literature, edited by Cleanth Brooks. And I started looking through this thick book, and I came on somebody named Walt Whitman. I had never heard of him. And he said, "I celebrate myself and sing myself and what I assume you shall assume." And I thought, wow, can you actually write that way? That kind of immediacy. I flipped through that book more, and I found Wallace Stevens. I'd certainly never heard of Wallace Stevens, Domination of Black, and he was talking about the peacocks and the hemlocks and the cry of the peacocks and the wind. And he saw the fire turning and looked outside and saw the leaves turning and looked up at the stars and saw the stars turning. And wow, that metaphor of far and near at once. And it hit me, that's what poetry is. And it was my introduction to the terror of the sublime, really, that cry of the peacocks and the hemlocks and the great distances to the stars. So those two poets probably affected me most at the very beginning.
Walt Whitman was kind of a wild man, right?
He sure was. He still is. He has a
Is it?
lot of influence. I'll tell you, I was just reading passages from Look Homeward, Angel, and I could see that deep influence of Walt Whitman on those catalogs, all the sensory imagery piled up. It's so much like Walt Whitman's poetry. And Wolf's talking about the sleepers, at night, who's sleeping here and who's sleeping there and who's snoring and who's awake and looking. That is right out of Whitman's great poem, The Sleepers.
So when you, it's so interesting that people read somebody else's writing and then they realize, oh, I can do that. I mean, that's allowed. They get permission from other writers. When you're working with your own students, do you tell them that nothing is off limits, that everything is permissible? It might not sell. You might not like the outcome of it in the end, but allow yourself to write any way that your instinct tells you to.
Oh, you got to take risks. Absolutely. If you're very timid about it, you're not going to accomplish a whole lot. So you begin with almost a recklessness. You try anything to see if it works. You don't know what you can do until you try it. And the most important word, I think, in teaching and encouraging writers is persistence. The people who succeed in any art are those who persist, whether it's country music or acting or, music. Classical music, you just have to keep on and on and on to get better. And
That is the
discouragement
truth.
can't stop you. I mean, you got to, the day after your novel gets rejected, you have to start revising it.
So, in terms of your novel writing, what's your subject matter? I mean, are you, I have to admit, I haven't read your fiction work, but do you have any consistency in terms of subject matter or theme, or do you bounce around?
Well, the first consistent thing is the setting in the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina, the Southern Appalachians. Almost all my fiction writing is set there. Second, history. I'm very interested in writing about earlier times, exploration, Cherokee Indians, 19th century, early 20th century, and beginning with the novel writing voice, to try to get the voice right from that era. Very risky. You've got to imply the dialect without it being too thick, because you want people to be able to read it. You want it to be sort of transparent, but they get a flavor of the speech. So you've got to be careful. But not overdoing that. Usually my novels are about people struggling, in the case of Gap Creek, poverty, con men, weather, floods, the vicissitudes of marriage, the first year of marriage,
Preachers coming and going,
preachers
perhaps.
coming and going, right? Religion. I think I'm one of the few writers of my time who really tried to see these preachers and religious people from inside. I don't try to satirize them or anything, but look at them honestly and let them tell their own story, their own
So
experience.
you've spent time with them and interviewing them and learning about getting their perspective. Is that what you're saying, Robert?
Well, I grew up with people who were very devout fundamentalists. My dad loved the Pentecostal holiness, but he was also a Baptist. My mother was a Baptist. So I heard a lot of preaching, a lot of hymn singing, and daily reading of the Bible when I was growing up. So I don't really have to do a whole lot of research on that. I'm
There you go. You are
kind of in the
steeped in it.
blood.
Yeah. Let me ask you about you said something earlier that you just reminded me of a question I wanted to ask with regard to poetry versus fiction writing. With fiction writing, this isn't always the case, but the majority of fiction writing is telling a story that people can track easily enough. This is a story I'm being told. Here's the characters. Here's what they're saying. Poetry is not that way. Poetry is much more along the lines of you need to interpret what the author is saying. You need to read into it to some degree. I mean, correct anything I just said that isn't that you disagree with, but what about that distinction between, because there's a lot of people that like to read books, but they just don't want to read poetry or don't get poetry. How does the reader need to approach poetry as distinct from reading a novel?
I think the first thing is to get a sense of the music and the texture of the words, the way description is often metaphoric. And with any good writing, it has to have surprise, word choice, some connection is made. Every poem is different, of course. I was very lucky in that I grew up in a place not only close to Thomas Wolfe, but very close to Carl Sandburg's house. So from the time I was very young, I was aware of this major poet over there writing poems about fog coming on Little Cat Feet or the harvest moon or the buffaloes are gone. I love that. I never met him, but I knew about him. Was aware of poetry. But poetry often leads to a moment of recognition. It often has narrative, but the ending of a poem is so important, and it's often the hardest thing for young poets to achieve is the right ending. You know when you've come to it, a moment of recognition and even stillness. Of resolution. And it usually has what I call reach. It's taken the reader somewhere they never expected to go, often far from where the poem begins. But it has a sense of resolution. It clicks, that sense of falling into place. And it's hard to describe it beyond that. But when you read a poem, you know it. And when you write a poem and you get there, you know it also.
So it's an ending that it's kind of that javelin hitting the turf, or the phrase I'm looking for. Well, a payload. You deliver that payload with that final phrase or that final sentence or what have you. If it's
Without a
not
summing
there.
up necessarily, but the reader knows this has come to a place that was unexpected, but seems inevitable once you get there.
And what about coming circularity, coming full circle? You see that a lot. I'm a big advocate of that with magazine articles and newspaper articles. Start where you finished in some way, especially if it's a feature story. In novels, I think do that to some degree. Is there circularity with poetry, or is it more linear? I hate to say linear because poetry is. I think that short sells poetry, but is there? Do you sometimes write poetry where the ending, the reason it resonates is because it echoes the start?
but in ways you could not have foretold. I was a math major at one point, and I often use mathematical analogies. I say to students, if a poem is linear, that means you can see where it's going from the beginning and it arrives there, and there's no surprise. Let's think of poetry as either quadratic or exponential. It's going to go in some other way. But when it arrives, it seems exactly right. And then you go back to the beginning and you realize the ending was implicit. You just didn't recognize it. It was
Now, you're a
you can make the
Southerner.
analogy to detective stories in that way. You begin a detective story and you can't know how it's going to end, but when you finish it, you go back and realize there was something there implying the ending you didn't recognize.
Gotcha, exactly. I know exactly what you mean. Now, you're a Southerner, and Thomas Wolfe was a Southerner, Carl Sandburg. There's so many great Southern writers. Faulkner. What is it about Southerners in storytelling? Is there some, what is it about the region that produces so many writers that are gifted storytellers?
Well, good writing basically comes out of the storytelling tradition. Often not a terribly literate culture. Let's take two others, the African American community and the Irish. These are great storytelling communities like the South. And I think it's the same thing. For a long time, the South was not. Oh, really, up there with, say, New England in terms of education and sophistication. And that tradition of storytelling, especially in the mountains where I'm from, I grew up with storytelling people who sat on the porch in the summer or by the fireplace in the winter telling stories. My grandpa, my uncles, my parents. I heard a lot of those stories and I've used them in my writing. There's something else in the South which I'm sort of reluctant to even understand, perhaps, it has to do with the history of the South and the history of slavery and the humiliation of the Civil War. It feeds into this tragic, even violent content, Gothic content in Faulkner, particularly, but certainly Thomas Wolfe and Robert Penn Warren and others. There's a let's take Warren's great novel, All the King's Men. And this absolutely brutal look at the politics of the South and the history of, you wouldn't find that necessarily in a novel set in New England. It might, something like it, but it would be very different. And
Right, they would
the
be.
attitude in that of Jack Burton, the main character, and his view of politics and of history, I wouldn't call it bleak. Let's say dramatic. If Faulkner is the great one, I mean, just think of the history implied in Absalom, Absalom, and Sound and the Fury.
Right. Is there content and wisdom in suffering and poverty and suffering? There's been a lot of that in the South. There's been a lot of riches in the South too, but there's also been a lot of poverty, a lot of suffering. You mentioned the humiliation of the Civil War, which is still called by some people the War of Northern Aggression. Is there content and wisdom in the suffering? Is that part of the nobody wants to suffer, nobody wants to be poor, but it doesn't mean that it doesn't have any usable byproduct.
It's there. It's always there. From the time I was really small, I heard stories about my great grandfather and his brothers, who, after Appomattox, walked home from Virginia. They were there at the end, and they were barefoot, and one of the brothers died on the way. They had to bury him on the way, John. So you grow up with that sort of thing. My other great-grandfather, another one, was Frank Pace, who was captured. He'd been at Chickamauga. He had been at Fredericksburg with Longstreet. He was captured near Petersburg and taken up here to Elmira, New York. Called Hellmira because they didn't feed him anything, and they were exposed to the worst winter on record over there on the Chemung River. He survived diphtheria and came back, and no bitterness at all. He was a Republican and said, "Let's move on." But he had these stories of the horrendous winter at Elmira and of the siege of Petersburg and Fredericksburg. He said he didn't know how anybody survived at Fredericksburg. The air was full of lead. Of course, it was just a massacre for the Union Army there on the flats by the river. So, yeah, you grew up with that history, which is specific to the region, and it is tragic, and there's a tremendous amount of suffering. Look at a picture of Atlanta after Sherman was finished with it. Look at a picture of Richmond, and then look at a picture of Ukraine right now, or
God.
Gaza,
Yes.
a world just destroyed.
Yeah, and people just struggling, but resolute in their struggle, resolute, certainly in Ukraine and certainly during the Civil War. So let me ask you about I want to revisit this question. First and foremost, do you consider yourself a poet or a fiction writer, or don't you necessarily rank one over the other or see a real distinction there for yourself?
Whatever I'm working on at the time, that's what I am.
What are you working on now?
Working on poetry and contemplating another long prose book, but it's not in any stage I can really talk about at this point, but primarily poetry and some short stories. I love to write short stories. In fact, in college, my first dream was to be a short story writer. And my first publications, I think, were short stories when I was in college, and then I fell in love with poetry and did not look back for a while. But there's really nothing comparable to finishing a short story when it really falls in place, and you've gotten to the end of it, because it combines the precision of poetry with the development of character and narration and tension of a novel, sort of all at once in this compressed form. And it's the hardest form there is. There's nothing harder than writing a short story, unless it's screenwriting, which also is so compressed.
Interesting. So the short, so there's also a more immediate satisfaction to it, I would imagine. You don't take as long to write a short story as a novel, not to say you dash them off, because as you're saying, it's the most difficult form, but there's a sense of completion, a sense of accomplishment, a sense of progress because you've completed a short story, maybe are moving on to the next short story that might be part of a collection.
Exactly. I can finish a story usually in 1 to 2 months.
Tell me about what you teach at Cornell. What are the various subjects? What are the books that you have your students read? What are the exercises you give them? Give us just an overview.
I was hired to teach poetry workshops while the senior poet Ammons was on leave for 1 year, and then I was kept on for another year. So in my early years at Cornell, I primarily taught poetry workshops. But I don't have a PhD, but this faculty was so generous, they invited me to teach American literature, particularly 19th century literature, Walt Whitman, Emily Dickinson, Emerson, Thoreau, that sort of thing. So in the late 1970s and early 80s, I taught a lot of graduate workshops in American poetry of the 19th century and early 20th century. Then, at about 1982, 83, I began to write fiction and didn't have time to do all that research on teaching literature. So I returned to teaching workshops, fiction and poetry. My philosophy of teaching is that you can't teach it. That's the first thing to tell students. This is not a subject that can be taught, but I can serve as a kind of coach. Learning to write is teaching yourself and all those hours at the typewriter or at the yellow pad. But it helps sometimes to get some feedback from somebody else, a reader, and that's what you are as a teacher. You read what they write and maybe have some pointers, maybe not. But your greatest effect is just to get them writing. As long as they're writing, they will teach themselves. But I do not believe that you can actually teach anybody to write. And you have to be upfront about that. You have to tell that workshop, that graduate seminar, that you're not exactly there as a teacher. You're there to maybe help them with suggestions or something. It's all done in your head with it's like athletics. I mean, how do you learn to play basketball? You play it and you play it and you play it, and at that that game that's so important when you get up there and throw the ball, you're that may take a couple of seconds, but you're using what you've learned in 10,000 hours of practice, and writing is somewhat the same way. It's
Spoken like a
acting.
true Tar Heel, bringing a basketball. I think the Tar Heels are currently ranked number 3 or 5 in the nation, so they're right in the thick of it
Right.
there. How does Thomas Wolfe fit into your curriculum? Do you literally give? Of course, his books are so big, not all of them, but are you able to assign Thomas Wolfe, or is that do you have to? Is that just too compendious? A volume for them to handle in a semester along with other work.
I have never assigned him. In fact, I have never really assigned Southern writing. My students are mostly from the Northeast, in fact, more from New York City. And I've rarely talked about my own writing. I found it much more effective to tell the students the subject of this class is your writing. And as a teacher, you create a space which they can fill with their writing. I've never found it particularly useful to talk about my own writing. My cover was blown by Oprah when I was on the Oprah show. My students learned I was a writer and learned something about my writing. And but before that, I had rarely, I won't say never, talked about my own writing because I found it better to talk about their writing.
Oh, I didn't know about Oprah. So, did Oprah was a particular book that she had recommended? Was it one of her Oprah picks, and she had you come on?
Gap Creek was her
Gap
three
Creek.
selection.
Okay, and that's your number one selling, but that was a New York Times bestseller. Gotcha. How interesting that you got to spend time with her. What was that experience like? For instance, before she even started filming. Was there any upfront time with her?
Not a whole lot. She's a very busy person, but the experience all over was wonderful. She sent a film crew down to South Carolina, and we filmed some interview actually on Gap Creek there. It's a very fine film crew. I enjoyed talking with them. I spent a couple of days with them. Flew out to Chicago and went through the whole thing, makeup and that sort of thing, and she came in, and almost immediately we started filming. It was wonderful, a good conversation. And then there was a dinner afterward, fine chef, and she came in, and let's see, the first thing she said was, "Therapists tell me that the thing women complain most about is having to have sex with their husbands." And the other people around the table were, I think, were all women, or maybe there was one other guy, and they were talking about this. And Oprah said, "Well, Robert, you're not saying anything." And I said, "Well, I'm taking notes for my next novel."
Yeah, and I don't hear any complaints from my wife.
Well, what could I say? I mean,
Yeah, exactly. You're outnumbered there. Let's talk about what was distinctive about Thomas Wolfe's writing style. He has stood the test of time. He was standout in his lifetime. He stood the test of time. What's distinctive about Thomas Wolfe's writing style? Obviously, lit you up as well. Mentioned earlier how his prose kind of, set you on fire. Talk about what's special or distinctive about his writing.
there's several things I think that are very distinctive. The first thing you notice, especially as a young writer, is these choral passages, very lyrical, "Oh, lost and by the wind grieved ghost, come back again." That's really impressive, when you're young, and it seems like Shakespeare and the Bible, together. And that's the first thing that grabbed me, and I think other young readers, and especially young writers, there's just nothing quite like it in American literature. It's like, Euripides or something. And then the brilliant writing about place, architecture, Asheville, Altamont, and the landscape, the mountains, the stream, trains. He writes so beautifully about trains. When you're a little older and you go back and read it, you notice the wonderful satire of people in the greasy spoon talking, the gossip, the doctors talking when they're off duty, that kind of thing. That really, really impressed me when I went back and read him. Didn't so much when I was very young. When I was very young, I was intoxicated by seeing myself in Eugene Gant and my parents and his parents. It's an amazing parallel. The mother, the businesslike one, the father, roaring and building big fires and all these great feasts they have, and the bad businessman. I certainly felt a connection there with my dad, who was really, really bad at business, but a wonderful person, full of energy and rhetoric, read books. Even though he was just a dirt farmer, he read lots of books, especially history. So I can't claim to come from, the kind of impoverished background, even though we had no money, that other mountain people were. I knew something about ideas and things from my dad. I got to Look Homer and Angel from the bookmobile. One of my sources of books was this bookmobile that came around every first Monday in the month. And I had gotten Jack London from that bookmobile and David Copperfield and things. And then one day I went out and saw on the shelf this huge gray covered book called Look Homer and Angel. Now I knew about that book because Wolfe had been featured in the paper as a kind of scandalous man writing about the scandals of Asheville. I knew I had to read that book, took it home, and of course just fell in love with it. This wild kamikaze prose. we who are about to die, kind of tone. And
So the fact that he's from Asheville played big
oh
in his
boy,
writing.
if he could write that way from Asheville, maybe I could do something too.
There you go.
It
And
was only later that I recognized he was a city boy looking at the country people telling the stories. I was the country people telling those stories myself. But I still felt a kinship.
Yes. So he attended North, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, like you, and his all that he develops a passion for writing and theater, and he contributed to the student newspaper and literary magazines. He graduates in 1920 and goes to Harvard for a graduate degree and studied playwriting there. It sounds almost as if the his interest in writing novels came later. It developed over time because he was interested in playwriting and writing for theater, for writing
Right.
for the screen, and so on.
Well, I think what happened was that he was trying so hard to get plays produced, very hard to break into theater. Somebody, I think it might have been his mistress, Aline Bernstein, said, "Your prose writing's wonderful. You might write a novel." And he started writing, and it just he hit the stratosphere with it. His education was much smoother than mine. I was much more confused than he was. I went away to college at 16, as he did. I didn't go to Chapel Hill originally. I went to Emory College at Oxford because they admitted people who hadn't graduated from high school. I never graduated from high school. And there strangely fell in love with mathematics. I was the best student in the class, and decided I wanted to be a rocket scientist. And of course, where I wanted most to go was Caltech, but that was 3,000 miles away, and I didn't have much money, so I went instead to NC State in the aerospace program. Realized very quickly I was not an engineer, but I liked math, so I transferred to math, and it was doing well, taking calculus and differential equations and that sort of thing, and studying mechanics and the Bernoulli effect and stuff like that. And then that almost through accident, my advisor refused to let me take a more advanced class in differential equations. And he said I'd never graduate from high school and he wouldn't let me accelerate like that. And I saw in that time slot I could take creative writing with the novelist Guy Owen, the man who wrote the Flim Flam Man, became the basis of the of the movie. And I never looked back, really. I took some math courses at Chapel Hill, more advanced math courses, but my heart was in writing. And Chapel Hill was the perfect place to be. There were such good students, such good faculty. And after leaving the engineering school at NC State, I just love that quad at Chapel Hill, the old trees, the statues, the Georgian brick buildings. And at the end of the quad, the lower end, was this great domed classical building. I said it was like a gift from classical antiquity. So it was a place to be.
Interesting that you have an aptitude both for a hard science and in literature. And I didn't realize you were a member of the Wolf Pack there at NC State before becoming a Tar Heel.
For 1 year, yes.
Just
And
1 year, and that
my
kind of severed
schooling
for
was
you.
the city of Raleigh.
There you go.
I had never lived in a city. I'd lived outside Atlanta for 1 year. But my parents never allowed me to see movies. They considered them kind of sinful. And I lived out in the country and had no way to get really to Hendersonville most of the time. So I spent a lot of my time in Raleigh going to museums, the art museum, the history museum, and to movies. I remember walking over to the Rialto Theater on Highway 70. There was something called Lolita, based on Vladimir Nabokov. That's the first time I ever heard of Vladimir Nabokov.
Another scandalous novel.
Absolutely. And you go into that, and James Mason is going to this big house, and the furniture turned over and everything, and he looking around, and he calls Quilty, and eventually this sheet over a chair is thrown aside, and Peter Sellers stands up looking somewhat hungover. Never forgot it. Never forgot Kubrick either. Kubrick is such a great director.
Yes, yeah, exactly. So 1929, he publishes Look Homeward, Angel. He's only 29 year 28 29 years old, and smash hit right off the bat. It was considered, I mean, it was a critical success, but controversial, as you had touched upon, because of the way he portrayed family and personal relationships. My understanding is Thomas Wolfe was a very his manuscripts were voluminous. He wrote long, long manuscripts, and Max Perkins, his editor, I think a lifelong editor, had to really work with him to winnow it down. I mean, he would well, Thomas Wolfe would have liked to have written it in its entirety or published it in its entirety, but Max Perkins had to work with him to say, we need to get this down to a manageable size. I mean, the
Well,
printing
they
press won't
brought
even
the
handle
manuscript
it.
into the office, I think in a packing crate or in a big suitcase. It was called what? Oh, Lost, I believe. In fact, I've read that manuscript and wrote a blurb for it when it was published. It begins with an 85 page section about the father before he came to Asheville. And Perkins, of course, carved that down to, more like 20 pages, I think. But Wolfe had absolutely no ability to edit his work. He had a serious weakness there. He could not edit it. He needed somebody else to edit it. So he formed this partnership with Max Perkins, and Perkins did a great job of filleting out the best parts of it, condensing some parts, and turning it into a great novel. It was a great success, popular success, critical success, and it was published the same year as A Farewell to Arms and The Sound and the Fury, and I think a novel by Sinclair Lewis. It was the year Sinclair Lewis won the Nobel Prize, I believe. But it may have had the largest response of any of those novels when it came out. He was a real literary lion in a way that Faulkner was not. Faulkner certainly had an audience, was an avant-garde writer, but Hemingway was a celebrity also, but he wasn't in New York, and Wolfe was in New York. He was lionized, and his later novels are about being a literary lion. You Can't Go Home Again, for instance.
Yeah, talk about that one. That one was published posthumously, is my understanding, and 1940. He died in 37, 38,
Well, he
37 or
only
38.
published two novels in his lifetime, Look Homeward, Angel, and Of Time and the River. And people began to say that he couldn't write a novel without Perkins, that Perkins was the co-writer, that he was crippled without Perkins, so he broke with Perkins. This was a disaster, of course, personally and emotionally and professionally, really. So the rest of his life, he did not have anything to do with Perkins, and just wrote tons and tons and tons of manuscripts about a character named George Weber, who's clearly Wolfe himself. He changed his physical appearance, but it's still, he's rewriting Look, Homer the Angel, essentially, Out of Time on the River. So when he died at the age of 39, he published, I think, a book about writing called The Story of a Novel. And that was it. He published a lot of short stories in Scribner's Magazine and other places. And as he was dying or about to die, he wrote a letter to Perkins, essentially telling him that, he was sorry he had broken away from him. He realized that Perkins was so important to him emotionally. He was a kind of father to him. And Perkins, I think, published that letter. It's incorporated, or one very much like it, into You Can't Go Home Again. But Webb and the Rock and You Can't Go Home Again and The Hills Beyond and several other things were posthumously published and edited, heavily edited by an editor whose name I think is Edward Answell. We don't know, or I don't know exactly how much editing he did, or did he add very much to it. But those two novels were edited by him out of the manuscript. And the second of You Can't Go Home Again includes a novella that's a masterpiece called The House That Jack Built, based on his own experience with a family, his mistress and her husband, a very, very successful businessman, Mr. Bernstein, and a party they have the night before the stock market crashes in 1929.
Wow.
And before the novel is published at almost the same time as the stock market crash. But you want to look that up. It really is a masterpiece.
And that
And
title again is.
The House That Jack Built, and of course he's punning on Jack, money, of course. These are very wealthy people who are about to lose all their money in the stock market crash. Wealthy Jewish people, and that's sort of important to him. And but they're just wonderful things in that last book and in The Web and the Rock also. Let's see, what are another one of the great sections in The Web and the Rock? I can't remember the title of it, but they're not quite as good as novels as Look, Homer, the Angel, but they have wonderful things in them. One of the critics of Wolfe has suggested it really was a kind of inspired by novella writing. It wasn't novels, but sections, short stories and longer stories, like The Death of Ben in Look, Homer, the Angel, or that The House That Jack Built. It's actually about 150 pages. It's not that short, but it's unified in a way that his longer works aren't necessarily unified.
Interesting. So if Thomas Wolfe was to come back today, reincarnated for a couple of days, what would you want to know from him? What are a few of the things that you would want to ask him or have him expound on?
I would first ask him what he had in mind in the last year before he died, as I had the idea that he really was leaning toward nonfiction. The last real big thing that he did was to take a tour of the Western parks, national parks, with two other men, and he kept a diary of it, which has been published. I have an essay about that diary, which I delivered as a lecture for the Thomas Wolfe Society a few years ago. But at that time, I thought he was leaning toward nonfiction history and writing about the natural world and the environment. He was also becoming much more interested in politics. This is the Depression, remember? It's the time when people are out of work, people are suffering. And he was becoming increasingly interested in that, getting away from the egocentricity of his writing before that. And most of his writing is about his own experience in almost all of his books. But he was becoming very interested in solving the problems of the nation, of all these people out of work, starving, of the unsettledness of the country and of the natural world out there, the great, the Rocky Mountains, the Cascades, the great deserts. You can see that in the diary he kept, that he was moving toward something else. And I would like to ask him what it was. What did he have in mind?
Interesting. So he ended up dying in 1938, September 1938. He was only 37 years old. It was tuberculosis, I understand. And where did he get that? I mean, didn't his mom run a some kind of boarding house and he would visit, perhaps? And could he have picked it up there? But his mom, I don't think, ended up with tuberculosis. So what happened there? Is there any information on how he ended up with tuberculosis?
Asheville was a resort then, particularly for people with tuberculosis who came. They thought the mountain air was good for them, and many came to that boarding house run by his mother, and he lived in that boarding house actually for years. He divided his time sometimes between that house and the house that his father owned, but he was exposed to a lot of tuberculosis, and the doctors think that he had tuberculosis, but his immune system kept it in check in his lungs. And for some reason, on this trip, which was very strenuous through the parks, driving day after day, night after night, it broke loose, went into the bloodstream, and went to his brain and attacked probably, the meninges. So it was tubercular meningitis, could be encephalitis. I don't know which it was. And of course, that started eating up his brain and he died pretty quickly. I just finished a biography of Edgar Allan Poe, and my belief is that Poe died the same way, that he had been exposed to TB all his life. He went on a terrible binge in Philadelphia and it caused it to break out of his lungs and went to his brain, and
What
he
kind of
didn't die.
binge? Like a drinking
He didn't
binge?
die of drunkenness. He did not die of a rabid bat bite. He did not die of diabetes. But in my mind, and other people, I'm not the only person who think that he died of tubercular meningitis, and that was eating up his brain.
Wow. Horrid.
And they died in the same city. They both died in Baltimore.
What, how has the critical response to Thomas Wolfe's work evolved over time? I mean, is he regarded differently today than, say, 25 or 50 years ago? What would you say, how would you say his reputation has evolved, if at all?
Which declined precipitously in my lifetime. When I was young, he was considered one of the major writers in the anthologies of American literature. He's basically been dropped from that. Harold Bloom, major critic of our time, said one cannot discuss the literary merits of Thomas Wolfe. He has none. He has been dismissed more recently, accused of anti-Semitism and racism. He is considered someone who overwrites, who's very immature in his writing, but the public has not dropped him. He also parallels Poe in that way, that a lot of the critics disparage Poe as a children's writer, essentially a cheap commercial writer of detective stories and sentimental verse and that sort of thing. But the public loves them and keep reading them. Not all critics disparage Wolfe. He has his defenders, especially in the South, especially in North Carolina. There is a Thomas Wolfe Society that is worldwide. They meet in Paris one year and, Atlanta another year. But the readers, are still there. And one of the charges against Wolfe is that he's a writer for the young. And there's some truth in that. That there's a way his writing, particularly Look Homeward, Angel, affects 15, 16-year-olds. that is really special. I've met so many people who say exactly what I say, that he intoxicates you in a way that nobody else, except maybe Walt Whitman, does. That you just feel that, this is the way young people feel, this confusion, this passion, this curiosity. He gets that all down better than anybody else. Faulkner, when he first read him, said this, he puts more into it. He puts himself into it with a passion that none of us can match. I don't know if Faulkner continued to believe that, but when he read Look Homeward, an Angel in 1929, I mean, this is the guy who just published, The Sound and the Fury. And he thought that Wolfe had surpassed them all, taken in the same way the rest of us are by it. Pat Conroy says, to hell with the critics. All the overwriting, it's there, but, he transcends it. And I think that's basically true.
Well, and it's said that he grappled with this concept of identity. That's a universal theme there. The whole idea of, people are always trying to kind of figure out who they are, to establish a sense of identity. Where do I fit in here? Who am I really? Where did I come from? Where am I going? What's my place? Talk about that a little bit. What about how did he portray that in his writing?
He does it better than almost anybody else. He's in a tradition of writing what the Germans call what the Künstlerroman, the novel of apprenticeship, Wilhelm Meister's apprenticeship, Goethe. Wolf is always writing, or almost always writing, about the young artist and how the young artist himself evolves, what feeds into his sensibility, all the sights, the sounds, the faces, the rivers, the trains, the things that have been influenced him. And it is identity, but in particular the identity of an artist, in this case a novelist. He does it better, I think, than anybody else since Goethe, maybe. And the Germans, of course, just loved his writing, and it was a bestseller there. They loved him. He spent some time there and got in terrible trouble at the Oktoberfest. He was almost killed in a fight.
Too much beer and sausage, huh?
I guess so. He drank heavily, and he drank very heavily in Germany. And then he became very disillusioned with Germany because of the rise of Nazism. And
Yes,
in this
even though he was
period,
an anti-Semite, or people claimed, he's anti-Semitic, but he did not find any affinity with the fascism or
Nazism.
Nazism.
He was anti-Semitic only when he was drunk. When he was drunk, he would go into rages about his or to his mistress. I think otherwise he was really fascinated by Jewish people, their sophistication, their knowledge, their wit. He really loved this woman, Aline Bernstein.
Was that his muse? Was his mistress his muse?
She sure was, and she was the one who encouraged him in his writing, encouraged him to write fiction, and I believe helped him get published, because she knew everybody. She was a set designer, a very famous one, and he met, when he was totally unknown, trying to get plays produced and that sort of thing, and she helped him, encouraged him, inspired him. Aline Bernstein's very important in his biography.
So her and Max Perkins were the two key figures, it sounds like, in his writing career.
They certainly were. He was a tempestuous, passionate person, given to rages, tantrums, crying, very emotional. And she kind of calmed him down and helped him see what was possible for him to do, which is writing fiction. I mean, he was so verbose, he couldn't have been a playwright. I mean, playwrights are so good at just the opposite, at condensing language and writing a great scene, very, very economical dialogue, that sort of thing. And his talent was in the opposite direction. Fitzgerald said he would be a taker-outer, said he should be a taker-outer, and very angrily, Wolfe replied, "I'm a putter-inner." Fitzgerald was a very generous man, and he was trying to help him. He recognized that he had this problem of overwriting, but Wolf couldn't see it. He resented it.
Now, was Aileen Bernstein herself Jewish?
Yes.
Okay, so how could he really be anti-Semitic if he's, I mean, he just gave voice to anti-Semitism when he was drunk. Was it directed at her, or was it more general than that?
Sometimes was. I mean, they quarreled, and their relationship became not unlike D.H. Lawrence's with, Frieda Richthofen, quarreling and shouting, that sort of thing. And Wolf did things that really, really were beneath him later on. When he tried to break away from her, he was not nice to her. He was rude to her. There's no use to try to sugar that. I mean, it really was true.
Now, you say his miss. Oh, I'm sorry. Finish that thought, Robert.
But she was his mistress.
So he was married and she was the woman on the side.
He was never married. He was never married. She was married to a very wealthy businessman. And the house that Jack built is very autobiographical. He goes into great lengths to portray this tolerant husband who never, did anything to him, but let his wife invite him to parties. And
so he knew what was going on, and he just let it be. He was okay with
tolerant.
It to some degree, at least.
He was very tolerant of it. He knew his wife was a great artist, a set designer, and at this point in her life, she had a grown daughter already that she needed this relationship. But I think his behavior later really cannot be excused. His heavy drinking just led him into doing things that really were bad. There's no use to try to excuse him.
And true of a lot of writers late in life, right, who have substance abuse problems and behave exceptionally badly.
His drinking got worse and worse. He was unhappy once he broke away from her and Perkins. So he had this double severing in his life, and his last years were heavy drinking and confusion and writing page after page after page, things he didn't know what to do with. Left this mountain of manuscript, which Aswell assembled into these last novels after his death. It's not a happy story after he broke away from Perkins and Aileen Bernstein.
Yeah, it's a shame, really a shame. So, Robert, this was my guest has been Robert Morgan, by the way. Again, he's a professor at Cornell University, a novelist, a poet, a Thomas Wolfe expert, and shares an October 3rd birthday along with Thomas Wolfe. What sign does that make you?
Libra.
You're a Libra. Okay. So, and you're at work now on your next project, poetry. I think you're working on poetry and a little bit of short story writing right now. Is that right?
Short stories and poems and thinking about a new prose work.
Okay. So yeah, you're working on it. It's still taking shape. But Gap Creek was your bestseller and it drew the attention of Oprah Winfrey. You were interviewed by her. Now that was what do they call it? It's an Oprah book selection. Was
book
that
club
an Oprah selection?
Selection?
Is that right? Yeah.
The Oprah Book Club selection. Yeah.
There you go. There you go.
My other bestseller is a biography of Daniel Boone called Boone, a Biography, which has been a national bestseller.
Now, you know what? I saw a news report. This was decades ago, Robert. And somebody had found a cove this in the woods, and there was a piece of wood with a piece of sheet metal affixed to it, and punched into that sheet metal. It said Boone, and they thought they had found his final place. How did Daniel Boone die? Do we know?
Died at the age of 86. In 1820, with his family surrounding him, and out in St. Charles, Missouri. He had moved to Missouri in 1799 because it was wilder, and he'd lost all of his land in Kentucky to lawyers, essentially.
And where does he hail from? Is he from your part of the world?
He was born in Pennsylvania, near Reading, on a farm there, the Quakers. His father quarreled with the Quaker Church, and they moved first to Virginia and then to North Carolina, where he grew up, became a hunter. He dreamed of going to this paradise over the mountain called Kentucky, this great hunting ground with buffalo, elk, and that sort of thing. And he finally made it in 1769 with a group, fell in love with it, and vowed he would go settle there. And he did in 1775. Was a surveyor, very successful businessman for a while, but he kept bad business records and was cheated out of all of his land, as I say, by lawyers,
Jeez,
and
terrible.
was given a tract of land in Missouri, which was still kind of wild, and he loved Missouri. He could go up the river. He actually went as far as Yellowstone with a group of trappers in his old age, and died very beautifully in 1820.
With
Family around him.
family and friends at a side.
His daughter-in-law sang for him, that sort of thing. Oh yeah, it's a very moving scene. It was in writing about it was inspired by reading The Death of Ben and Look Homeward, Angel. I actually mentioned
Wow.
that in a lecture on Boone, which I gave.
Interesting. Interesting. So, I of course learned about Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett in school. Growing up in upstate New York, we learned all about him, but it was so long ago. I didn't retain that, but you've written a biography on the man as well. Robert, this was really interesting. I appreciate you taking the time. I'm envious that you live in Ithaca, New York, beautiful Ithaca, New York. And get to sail on the Cayuga Lake and the other Finger Lakes out there. And
That's a
but
wonderful place.
it is. I appreciate you taking the time. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.